Welcome. Thank you for standing by. Throughout today's conference, all participants will remain in listen-only mode. During the Q&A portion of the call, you may press star one if you would like to ask a question. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. Now I'll turn your conference over to Katie Matthews. Thank you. You may begin.
Thank you. Good morning, and thanks, everyone, for joining us on this monthly climate update call, which is part of a suite of climate services that NOAA provides to government, business, academia, and the public to support informed decision-making. I'm Katie Matthews from NOAA's National Centers for Environmental Information, and I'll be facilitating the call today. Today's update is going to feature three short presentations followed by an operator-assisted question and answer session. First and foremost, a copy of the presentation can be found and downloaded from http://www.ncdc.noaa.gov/SOTC/briefings. Our first presenter today is Jake Crouch, a climate scientist at NOAA's National Centers for Environmental Information, who will provide a summary of the May U.S. and global reports and the drought monitor released earlier today. Our next presenter is Jordan McLeod, a regional climatologist with the Southeast Regional Climate Center, who will discuss the heavy rainfall and related impacts across the Southeast during the month of May. And finally, as we look ahead, we'll have Brad Pugh, a seasonal forecaster at NOAA's Climate Prediction Center, who will provide the latest El Niño-La Niña update, as well as the monthly and seasonal temperature, precipitation, and drought outlooks over the next 3 months. And so with that, I will turn it over to Jake Crouch from NCEI.
Hi, everybody. Thanks for joining us this morning. I'm going to start off speaking to slide number two on the slide deck you can download from our website, looking at global temperatures for the month of May. The May global average temperature across ocean and land surfaces was 0.8 degrees Celsius above the 20th century average, and this marked the fourth warmest May on record for the globe since our records began in 1880, and marked the 401st consecutive month with average temperatures at least nominally above the 20th century average. The map on the right shows how temperatures broke down across the globe during the month. We noticed that there were some areas that were record warm, particularly parts of the contiguous U.S., which I'll talk about more in a moment. Every ocean basin had at least some regions that were record warm. We also saw large areas of record warmth across Europe. Many nations in Europe, including Norway, Germany, Finland, and Denmark, each had their warmest May on record. And this did mark the second consecutive month that Germany has experienced record warmth for a nation. The United Kingdom had its second warmest May. Austria had its fourth warmest May. And in Argentina, in the southern hemisphere, they had their seventh warmest May, with numerous locations across that country experiencing a record precipitation with record flooding observed in parts of Argentina. Looking at land and ocean surfaces separately, it was the seventh warmest May for global land surface, and this was the coolest May since 2011, and I've already mentioned some of that noteworthy warm temperatures. For the ocean surface, it was 0.66 degrees Celsius above average, and it was the fourth warmest May on record for the ocean surface of the globe. Moving on to slide number three, this is our horse race graph comparing average temperatures for 2018 to date compared to the eight ultimate warmest years for the globe. So as you move from left to right for each of these lines, this is a cumulative average for that year to that point. So we see the black line for 2018, so the end of that line indicates the January through May average temperature for the year. And we did tie 2010 as the fourth warmest January through May on record at 0.77 degrees Celsius above average. A couple of noteworthy things about this, even though we're not near record as near record warm as we saw in 2015, 16, and 17, this is the warmest we've seen a start to a year when La Niña conditions have been present. This 0.77 degrees Celsius is about 0.2 degrees Celsius above the previous record when we had La Niña conditions, which was in 2009. And we can see that 2009 line there in gray at the bottom of the chart. So we're quite a bit ahead of the pack, quite a bit above every other La Niña year, but off of the record mark for the year so far. Moving off to slide number four, looking at conditions here in the contiguous U.S. during May, it was a record warm May for the contiguous U.S. with an average temperature of 5.2 degrees Fahrenheit above average. The map on the left shows how those temperatures broke down during the month. We did see areas of record warmth across the Northwest, much of the Great Plains, Midwest, and stretching into the Mid-Atlantic. We did see some near-average conditions across parts of the West, particularly in California, and near-average conditions in parts of Florida. Arkansas, Illinois, Indiana, Kentucky, Missouri, Ohio, Oklahoma, and Virginia each had a record warm May. A particular note were overnight low temperatures during the month of May. We broke the previous record for overnight low temperatures by 2 degrees Fahrenheit, which is a pretty significant jump compared to the previous record that was set in the 1980s. Looking at the previous record warm May that impacted the U.S. in 1934, 1934 was during the Dust Bowl years, and it was a very dry month. May 1934 was the driest May on record for the U.S., and that record was set largely due to warm daytime temperatures. So we kind of broke the record in a different way by overnight lows being so record high compared to 1934, which was driven by really warm daytime temperatures during the drought. Looking at precipitation during the month of May, overall, it was a near-average month with some regional extremes. I'll skip over the record precipitation in the southeast since Jordan will be speaking to that. But we did see below-average precipitation across parts of the northeast, the lower Mississippi River Valley, parts of the southwest, and along the west coast. Moving off to slide number five to look at year-to-date temperatures for the contiguous U.S., there's a typo on here, so I apologize and I will update this. This was the 21st warmest year to date with a temperature about 1.6 degrees Fahrenheit above average. The map on the left shows how temperatures broke down during the month. We did see some record and near record high temperatures across the southwest with below average conditions stretching from the northern plains into the Midwest. And looking at the year-to-date time series on the right, we see where we are in 2018, above average, but kind of near average for this century. So we've been warmer than average and above average compared to much of the rest of the pack, but closer to average conditions when we look at just this century. Looking at U.S. drought monitor that was released this morning, 27.1% of the lower 48 was in drought. And this is down about 1.5 percentage points since early May. We did see drastic drought improvement across the southeast with the heavy precipitation there, as well as parts of the Great Plains. Drought did intensify and expand across the mid-Mississippi River Valley, parts of the south, northern plains, and west, particularly in the southwest, where a significant extreme and exceptional drought have kind of taken hold in that part of the U.S. And we did see abnormally dry conditions develop in Hawaii and Puerto Rico, as well as parts of the Northeast and the lower 48. With that, I will pass it off to Jordan.
Thanks, Jake. So I'll pick up on slide number seven and spend a few minutes talking about the extreme rainfall that was observed across the Southeast U.S. last month, May 2018. So on this slide, I show two maps. Both of these were created using a gridded precipitation data set known as multi-sensor precipitation estimates. It's produced by the National Weather Service, and it basically blends together Doppler radar estimates with ground-based station observations. So on the map on the left, I just showed the precipitation totals during the month, and you can see that much of the region observed upwards of 5 inches of rain, but some areas saw anywhere from 10 to more than 20 inches of rain. Some of these areas include central and southern Florida, as well as western North Carolina in particular. The map on the right, I show the percent of normal precipitation during the month. And again, you can see that much of the region observed at least 150% of their normal precipitation, or you can also think of that as 1.5 times what they would normally get during May. But some areas, again, parts of central and southern Florida, Georgia, western North Carolina, they saw anywhere from 300 to nearly 500% of normal, or 3 to 5 times what they would typically observe during the month. Moving on to slide eight, I want to emphasize that, you know, the record wetness was not, you know, uniformly distributed across the month. In fact, the first half of the month was actually abnormally dry across much of the region. You can see that in the left-hand map there with the brownish-colored station observations there showing negative departures from normal. The exceptions were parts of central and southern Florida and northern Virginia. They were running a bit above normal during the first half. But things really began to pick up in the second half of the month. So that moving over to the right-hand image, you can see that nearly the entire region had positive or above normal precipitation for that second half of the month, anywhere from 2 to more than 5 inches above normal for many stations across the region. Moving on to slide 9, I want to show the precipitation rankings during the month. And so this is provided by the CERC Climate Perspectives tool. So the image I show at the left, basically for all of the first order or long-term stations across the region, you can see where their precipitation totals rank for the month. You can see that many stations observe within their top 5 May precipitation values on record. I want to highlight in particular that 23 long-term stations are what I define as having a period of record equaling or exceeding at least 50 years. They observed their wettest May on record. So I provide some of the more superlative totals there below. And I want to highlight in particular Stuart, Florida, and Asheville, North Carolina. Not only did they observe their wettest May on record, they actually observed their all-time wettest month on record. Stuart, Florida, with 24.20 inches, beat out their previous monthly record of 19.98 inches in June 1999. And Asheville, North Carolina, with 14.68 inches last month, beat out their previous record of 13.75 inches in August 1940. A really impressive station records there. And then also the last bullet point there, just emphasizing that quite a few stations observed impressive streaks of rainfall during the month. So Athens, Georgia in particular, one of the more impressive streaks, it observed its longest streak of 18 consecutive days with measurable or at least 0.01 inches of precipitation. This occurred from May 15th through June 1st. And amazingly, it surpassed its previous record in June 1963 by 4 days. Moving on to slide 10, I just want to briefly touch on the societal impacts that resulted from all of this heavy rainfall. So the map on the left, I plot all of the National Weather Service local storm reports for flooding, which is shown by the green circles, and for debris flows, which is shown by the orange or brown colored triangles. You can see the greatest concentration of these in portions of Virginia, western North Carolina, and northeastern Georgia. A lot of damaging and deadly debris flows, or what we would think of as mudslides, landslides, or rock slides, were observed in these areas and unfortunately resulted in 3 fatalities. Many roads were closed, and some of these were actually completely washed out, and that included Interstate 40 across portions of western North Carolina. Homes were flooded. One of the more dramatic examples I came across was 2 families had to be rescued by helicopter from the roofs of their homes in Caldwell County, North Carolina. Again, that's in the western part of the state. And then there were also numerous evacuations and swift water rescues as well. And then lastly, that little screenshot at the bottom right there, one of the more noteworthy stories that actually was in national news, 2 TV journalists from South Carolina had gone up into western North Carolina to cover subtropical storm Alberta, which, by the way, contributed some of the heavy rainfall during the end of the month. But unfortunately, as these 2 journalists were driving along the road, a tree fell onto their SUV and crushed and killed both of them. This tree was probably in saturated soils from all of the rains, and so it only took a little bit of wind to knock it over, and unfortunately, they were in the path of it. And moving on to slide 11, just want to briefly talk about the agricultural and livestock impacts. Needless to say, May was not a very good month for a lot of agricultural and livestock producers across the region. They started out the month with insufficient soil moisture from the dry conditions. And this prevented a lot of crop planting and also slowed the growth of pastures and hayfields during the first half of the month. During the second half, the persistent rainfall that finally came was helpful in that it replenished the soil moisture levels, but unfortunately, it came too quickly and too heavily as well. So this resulted in a lot of flooded fields and pastures, drowning crops, and requiring a lot of these fields to be replanted. Agricultural production came to a grinding halt again like it did in the first half of the month, with farmers unable to plant their crops, spray herbicides, cut hay, or harvest small grains. But this really increased weed and disease pressure on the crops. I'll stop there and hand it over to Brad.
Okay, thank you, Jordan. Moving to slide 12, in the upper left-hand corner, we have the average sea surface temperature anomalies for the time period May 20th through June 16th. And it shows above normal sea surface temperatures west of the dateline and also recently developing along the equator across the east central Pacific. Currently, ENSO neutral conditions are present, but we are beginning to see the positive sea surface temperatures at the surface, but also at the subsurface as well. And those positive temperatures at the subsurface have strengthened since April. Also like to note the positive sea surface temperature anomalies across the East Pacific. Conversely, below normal sea surface temperature anomalies are present across the tropical Atlantic. In the lower left-hand corner is the Climate Prediction Center and IRI probabilistic ENSO forecast. The red bars represent probabilities for El Nino for three-month periods going forward. And ENSO neutral conditions are favored to continue through July, August, September, but chances for El Nino increase to near 50% by the next three-month period, August, September, October, and those chances continue to increase and peak above 60% during the late fall and winter seasons. Moving to slide 13 now, the CPC July temperature and precipitation outlooks. The temperature outlook on the left indicates increased chances for above normal temperatures throughout a majority of the continental U.S. and Alaska. The highest probabilities for above normal temperatures are forecast across the interior west. There is a stripe of equal chances for below, near, or above normal temperatures forecast from New Mexico northward into the northern Great Plains. And across Alaska, the highest probabilities for above-normal temperatures are forecast for southwest Alaska and the Aleutians. On the right-hand side is the July precip outlook, which calls for increased chances for below-normal precipitation for New England, also the western Gulf Coast region and the Pacific Northwest. Above normal precipitation is favored across the southwest Four Corners region and also for parts of Alaska. Moving to slide 14, which is the CPC seasonal temperature and precipitation outlooks. Similar to the monthly outlook, the seasonal temperature outlook calls for enhanced odds for above normal temperatures throughout much of the forecast domain. Highest probabilities for above normal temperatures are forecast across the Great Basin and Pacific Northwest, also across parts of Alaska and New England. Lowest confidence in the temperature outlook is represented by equal chances for below, near, or above normal across the north central U.S. And the precip outlook calls for increased chances for above-normal precipitation over the mid-Atlantic, also from Southern California northeastward through the Southwest into the Central Rockies, Great Basin. A couple of areas with elevated chances for below normal precipitation include the Western Gulf Coast region, also the Pacific Northwest. And above normal precipitation is favored for the July, August, September season for much of Alaska. And the final slide, number 15, the seasonal drought outlook. A few areas targeted for development during the next three-month period. First off, parts of the Northeast, New England. Short-term rainfall deficits continue to increase across the Northeast. Some abnormal dryness has developed there, so calling for moderate drought to develop for parts of that region. Also, southern Puerto Rico and the leeward slopes of Hawaii, abnormal dryness has recently developed, and that those areas are forecast to degrade into moderate drought over the next few months. Another area for drought development across parts of the central parts of Texas, Hill Country region. Most likely area for improvement or removal of drought during this time period is across the Southwest Four Corners region, also the High Plains. A couple of reasons for that. Recent rainfall with the remnants of Hurricane Bud laid a foundation for beneficial rainfall, and moving forward, as we saw in the seasonal outlook, increased chances for above normal precipitation for part of that region. And also, it's a relatively wet climatology, July and August, with the monsoon rainfall. And that's all from for the PowerPoint here. I'll hand it back to Katie.
Thanks so much, Brad. We will now take specific questions from call participants. When you do ask your question, please try to identify who you would like to answer the question, if possible. And with that, I'll turn it back over to the operator to start the question and answer session.
If you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 and record your name at the prompt. Again, press star 1. Please check to be sure that your line is unmuted and record your name when prompted. Our first question comes from Brian Sullivan with Bloomberg News. Your line is open.
Thank you. I apologize. I got on the call a little bit late this morning. What drove May's record warm temperatures? And then a follow-up to that is, why is the Northeast have such above average chances for heat over the summer?
This is Jake. I can take a stab at your first question here. So looking at May across the lower 48, the record warmth was driven primarily by T-min or minimum temperatures or overnight lows. We did have a fairly wet conditions in the southeast and parts of the Midwest. So you have wet conditions that can cause minimum temperatures to be higher. We did see we weren't in a La Nina or El Nino, so those weren't at play. We did see some modes of climate variability in the North Atlantic as well as the North Pacific that favored above average temperatures. So pretty much that drove the jet stream further north during the month. We had a persistent ridge that set up, and it was in stark contrast to what we saw during April, where the kind of the opposite pattern was holding. So it's kind of a combination of these local factors with local precipitation, as well as synoptic scale features such as the ridge and climate variability modes that originated from the North Pacific and the North Atlantic, all acting in unison to kind of drive the outcome during the month.
Yeah, this is Brad. I can answer the second question, asking about the seasonal outlook for temperatures across the Northeast. The higher probabilities for above normal temperatures, a couple of reasons. The dynamical models were in good agreement showing above normal temperatures for that region. And the second factor, decadal trends show a warming signal fairly strong during the summer months across the Northeast. So those two factors lend and result in the higher probabilities for above normal temperatures.
What's going on the decadal level?
Oh, the decadal signal?
Yeah.
It's a warming signal over the past few decades.
Oh, but why, I guess, is my question.
Oh, why?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just what the observations are showing.
Okay.
So this is Jake. So we do see a long-term warming trend in the Northeast United States. That shows up in our data here at NCEI, and I'm assuming it's also showing up in the trend analysis that is done at the CBC. It's a pretty clear signal, and I think that is contributing to this.
Okay. Can you attribute it to anything? I'm sorry to keep asking questions.
Yeah, so this is Jake. So, yeah. You know, we do have long-term warming trend as part of a changing climate, and so that is definitely a contributor to the trend that we're seeing in the region.
Thanks, Jake.
Next, we have Doyle Rice with USA Today. Your line is open.
Yeah, just to clarify, I think you mentioned on that one slide that it says it's the second warmest year to date in the U.S., but that's not right. Is that correct, that slide?
Yes, Doyle, I'm sorry. Oh. This is Jake. That was a typo on my part, and I will update the slide deck when I get back to my desk.
What's the actual number?
It was 21st warmest year to date. And so an interesting note about that, you know, it was kind of off the record mark, but it was actually right on average when we look at this century's average temperature. So warm compared to the past, but right on the mark when we look at the average temperatures for 2001 through 2017.
Oh, I see what you're saying. You're saying it's this, it's kind of a typical year for years since 2000.
That is correct, yes.
2000. Okay. That was kind of my one question. Thanks.
And as a reminder, please press star 1 if you would like to ask a question and record your name at the prompt.
We'll hold just one more second for any remaining questions. Okay, if there are no further questions, we're going to wrap up the call today. First, I want to thank all of our speakers for their time and to everyone who participated in the call. I want to remind you to mark your calendars for some upcoming releases. The June U.S. climate highlights will be released on July 9th. The June global climate highlights will be released on July 18th, and then we will be right back here in a month at our next monthly climate call on Thursday, July 19th. We will be posting an audio of this call on NOAA.gov in the media advisory within the next 90 minutes. And if in the end you do have any follow-up questions, you can email myself, Katie Matthews, KATY.MATTHEWS at NOAA.gov, or Lauren Gaches, LAUREN.GACHES at NOAA.gov, and one of us will help get you in contact with the right speaker about your questions. And for that, this concludes today's call.
Thank you for your participation. You may disconnect your lines at this time.